Making a recipe that calls for butter? Make it better with European butter from France. With a minimum of 82% butter fat, it's no wonder French butter is the number one choice of chefs the world over. Whether you're whipping up an omelet, sauteing vegetables, or spreading it on toast, the rich, cultured flavor of butter from France always elevates. Be sure to look for Made in France on the label. And for recipes, tips, and tricks, go to tasteeurope.com.
I love eating desserts, and I always treated it as, a form of food. And at the time, I don't know if everybody thought of it that way. I think everybody pretty much thought it was a kind of indulgence or occasional treat or something that's just wild and, something that's not part of like a daily diet. But, I grew up in a culture where you can really eat dessert at any time of the day.
You're listening to The Taste Podcast. I'm Editor-in-Chief Matt Rodbard, here with Senior Editor Anna Hiesel.
On today's show, Matt talks to Piché Ong, a legend in the New York City pastry game and currently the pastry chef at Brothers and Sisters in Washington, D.C. Also on the show, I talk to Marcus Glocker, executive chef at Augustine and chef owner of Batard. But Matt, let's talk about Piché.
After studying architecture at UC Berkeley, Piché Ong eventually made it to New York and worked with a chef by the name of Jean-Georges Van Gerichten from 1998 to 2004, working at the restaurant 66, shout out to Sex and the City, and the enormous Spice Market located in the meatpacking district. Piché Ong is a living legend.
I have just recently been rewatching Sex and the City. There's so much good restaurant scenes on that show.
And 66 is all over this, all over it. Yeah.
What were the pastries and desserts that Piché was making at the time during this golden era of New York City restaurants?
Super innovative stuff. He was taking French technique and implementing the flavors and ingredients of Southeast Asia. He was doing desserts with passion fruit and jackfruit. He was making tapioca jewels. It was all really forward-looking. Also, Anna, can you imagine a world without salt and caramel?
I can't. I mean, it's like in everything now. Every candy bar.
Guess what? Piché pretty much invented that shit.
Wow. Here is Matt talking to Piché.
Piché Ong, welcome to the Taste Podcast.
Hello. Good morning. Hi, Matt.
Hello, old friend. We haven't seen each other in a couple of years. We've known each other for about a decade.
Yes, I know.
I love it.
We sort of grew up together in a way in New York, right?
I feel like that. I know. And I was writing about you probably in 04, 05. I've been such an admirer of your work, but also your friendship and your just being super, like, you talk some shit, Piché.
I do.
We goss a lot.
That's what you get when you've been around, right?
No, you're a good guy, of course. Two things about your bio that we always like talk about. Well, we don't always talk about, but this is like two things that stuck out was you went to Berkeley to start an institute of architecture. Is that right?
I did.
That's really cool. What was that? How did that roll and how did that kind of affect your career path towards pastry?
Well, first of all, I went to school because, I was born in Thailand in a Chinese family. My parents are strict, traditional Chinese family. And, they value education and they said you can do anything you want. Scrub toilets, become a chef, become a movie star, dancer, whatever you want to be, as long as you have education. And I wanted to study a little bit of science, a little bit of art, a little bit of writing, and just general, like overall, the idea of like learning context and how you can create a life or design or come up with ideas through a background of contextual concepts. And architecture fit that role, and that's why I went to architecture and Berkeley. But Berkeley, because mostly California, and I'm a little bit at that time a hippie, and I thought, Berkeley's perfect.
Are there any architects that you really admire that you studied?
Zaha Hadid, Frank Gehry. I love architects that think outside the box, and not necessarily think of something that has to do with structure, because that to me, I soon found out was more engineering and. And now becoming chef, I realize there's a lot of similarities because you have to work with guidelines, rules of cooking, technique, whatever the client wants, whatever the owner wants, whatever fits the style of the restaurant, price points, guest relations. I mean, it's exactly what architecture was, pleasing people, hospitality, and making people feel happy.
And also just like thinking outside the box too is I think pastry is a great, mm-hmm. and especially plated desserts, which you were well known for at Jean George, you know, that's out of the box
yes.
cooking,
yes.
right?
I do. I you know, working on the Jean George had to make me think outside the box, particularly at the time when it was still very new, right? Late 1900, was it 1900? No, last century.
Yeah. the late 1990s.
Right. And he had a string of restaurants that was kind of indescribable. Is it Thai? Is it French? You know, to me, it's just good food. But, you know, pulling resources that you like and making people appreciate them.
It's you. And let's we'll get to your time at Spice Market, but I want the second point I had is that you are a voracious Words with Friends and Scrabble player. You are the best player I've ever witnessed. And while you were an active cook in New York, you were playing with Frank Bruni, who was the restaurant critic and food writer at the time.
Yeah, did we play also? How do you know this?
I feel like we played a little bit, yeah.
Oh, we did?
Yeah, you kicked my ass.
I did.
You're good.
Let's start again. And Frank Bruni, let's start again, too.
I thought it was just like the funniest thing. Like, oh, yeah, I'm playing with Frank Bruni. I'm like, he's a critic of the paper. Or was a food writer at the time. Anyways, I love that about you. But let's talk about Spice Table. What was that like at that time? What were you doing at that restaurant? What kind of pastry were you cooking? And really, I want to take us back to that era of New York. A lot of our guests, I like to go back in time and talk about what New York was like during this period.
Right. Well, I came to New York first in 97, straight from California. I lived in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And in San Francisco, I mostly learned about, you know, respecting ingredients and cooking in a very simple way that highlights flavors and seasonal ingredients. And when I went to LA, it was a little bit more of, you know, going back to pleasing the clients. At that time, it was very industry driven. And you had to do food that, you know, was accessible to, you know, the Hollywood crowd, which, you know, to me is very similar to New York now, which is the money crowd, you know, who like food very simple. So,
which has changed so dramatically.
Very
in 2019 LA.
In both cities.
Yeah, completely.
So I came to New York and I knocked on a lot of doors and ended up at Jean George. And let's clarify here, because I actually started as one of his fish cooks and only because I wanted to be underneath him, next to him, and, you know, learn from him.
At the flagship.
Yeah,
JG, great.
And, you know, and I learned a lot and also had, you know, felt like I contributed a lot. So, but when I left there, we kind of just kept it open and I expressed to him that I wanted something you know, the realm of dessert, only because I like it. And, you know, and I was new in New York. I wanted to have a life where I could, you know, spend a whole day cooking and not smell bad after work.
So
you know, like
fish. The fish cooks, yeah.
They yeah,
really get
it smelled
skin.
Bad. So, yeah. You know, after like 5 years of doing that, you know, different restaurants, including Tabla, I decided, okay, I want to, you know, go back to pastry, which is where I started.
Were the hours different for pastry at the time? Were you working days and having your nights off?
Well, it's in general, it's always different. We work more during the day. We do planning, organizing, and you know, usually the service is very simple for dessert. It should be that way because, you know, there's a lot of baking and, you know, having all your mise en place ready beforehand. And so, you know, I know that was my calling for Jean George because then, you know, I had a lot to contribute, besides also becoming like a marquee name in the company. And so we opened 66 first. But by that point, we had already sketched out the idea of Spice Market. Because, you know, in one of those sessions, yeah, we were talking about Southeast Asian street food. And, you know, he's really well traveled in that area, Malaysia, Thailand, Hong Kong, China. And so, you know, after 66, we pretty much, you know, were ready to roll out Spice Market.
And that really lended to your background of growing up in Thailand, I'm sure. So that was like clearly he was building this restaurant slightly with his staff and saw you, the work you're doing at 66 and then transitioned that to Spice Market.
Yes.
Amazing.
So, yeah, you know, it's something that was really natural for me. And I never thought I would, you know, go that path of like highlighting, you know, my heritage in a way, into my work.
And Spice Market, man, what a restaurant. Like, is massive.
It's an epic opening.
Epic restaurant.
One of the first in the meat.
What year, remind us? Yeah.
Well, we started looking at the site, I think, right after the churn, 2000. And then after that, 2002, we opened.
Through 9/11.
Yeah.
You went through all the way.
Yes.
And this is well before the Meatpacking District became a destination.
Yes.
Florent was probably open.
I know.
Still.
It was, actually. Florent was, towards the final days of Florent, it actually lost its edge a little bit then. But because the Meatpacking has become... very general crowd as opposed to a clubby kind of house.
Yeah, even in 2002, 2003, it had made that turn.
Right.
Talk about some of the desserts you were doing at Spice Market and some of the highs there and maybe lows too. I don't know. Talk about whatever.
We had planned on it being sort of not a multi-unit restaurant from the start. So I had to make sure that there's something that's, everybody would like, but yet pushing the envelope a little bit. So the dessert that got me the most attention was Thai Jewels, which is tapioca dumplings that's in coconut milk soup. And in my version, I had like passion fruit and jackfruit. I introduced a lot of exotic fruits at that time to the New York dining scene. We didn't have an ice cream machine, and so I was making ice creams by hand in an Indian, based on two different cultures, which is China and India. So we had a kulfi and we had a hand spun ice cream in the style of, what you would find on the streets of Guangzhou or Shanghai. And then we put them in a Chinese takeout container. I think that was kind of fun.
It was the pageantry of the time. At the time, it was really revolutionary to serve something in a takeout container. It was
right.
Clever.
We had rice pudding, which is very common throughout Southeast Asia. So pretty much the dessert stayed the same during the whole time that I was there. And then when we rolled out the concept in different cities like London or Doha, the desserts, went with the rollout. And some of them also made it to the other concepts of John George, like the steakhouse in Las Vegas. So that's a pretty cool thing for me to see.
Yeah, your inspiration. Can we go back? Did you kind of invent the pairing of passion fruit and chocolate?
No, I think it's something that has been around, but I always am a big fan of sweet fruit with chocolate.
It's such
sour
a,
fruit with chocolate.
Yeah, sour, it's such a go-to, and even you could even say now, maybe even a cliche, but I mean, back in the day, holy shit, it was everywhere, and I feel like you were like the start of it.
I think it was unusual at the time.
Yeah.
I would say maybe salted caramel is more my thing because I remember when I first served salt with caramel or desserts in general, people hesitated. They were like, did the pastry chef use salt by mistake? I mean, and now that's everywhere, right?
Completely. It's a Starbucks latte flavor.
But I don't claim to have invented anything because we, basically everything has been around. It's just you interpret in your own way and make it yours.
Well said. I agree. My job as a journalist is to say things like you invented and point out your level and the hierarchy of the world.
Thank you. I'll take the credit.
Yeah, take the credit from me. But I wanted to also talk, and the timeline might be a little bit off, but you opened a restaurant called Pong.
Mm-hmm.
P*ONG. Yes. Really, really, really influential place. In New York, to me, it was influential because it was the first time I ever had like a real dessert tasting where you're serving multiple courses of sweets, of the pastry side in a format that was both fun but also felt structured. Tell us a bit about what that was like opening and what years and all that stuff.
Well, that was 2006. I started making plans for it. That was towards the end of Spice Market. I came up with a cookbook with Genevieve Coe called The Sweet Spot. What else was happening then? I was, well known as a New York City chef. And I was also approaching, a stage in my life where I thought that I should branch off on my own and do my own thing. And I thought long and hard about what I wanted to do. I remember at that point, and I still do, I love eating desserts, and I always treated it as, a form of food. And at the time, I don't know if everybody thought of it that way. I think everybody pretty much thought it was a kind of indulgence or occasional treat or something that's just wild and, something that's not part of like a daily diet. But, I grew up in a culture where you can really eat dessert at any time of the day. And in Japan and Europe, they mostly still do, croissant, pastries in the morning, cake in the afternoon. So I wanted to open a dessert-focused place and in a very small jewel-like box. and
West Village, is that right?
West Village on 10th Street. Yeah. So desserts were front and center because I was very, you know, most people know me to be the pastry chef. And but then I also wanted to do food because I do love to eat and I want people to come for whatever reason. And I had a tasting menu of, I believe it was like 8 or 10 courses that had some food and that led up to desserts. Mm-hmm. I knew there was a certain crowd that was going to appreciate mm-hmm. that. And at the time, I wasn't alone. There was Sam Mason and mm-hmm. Will Goldfarb.
Will Goldfarb's Room for Dessert?
Room for Dessert.
Amazing and, place too, man.
Yeah, Taylor.
Yeah, sure, Taylor.
But I, you know, looking back and even now, like I can say that I could also claim all the credit because there was Chickalicious before that. Sure. I would say that my take on it was that I also had food. And many of the dishes were raw because I didn't have a fully equipped kitchen. So there was a lot of crudo, salads, braised meats, you know, things that that
small plate. Courses, but yeah. Then you would transition into 4 to 5 dessert courses.
Right.
Now, let me ask you, I mean, what happened to this genre of dining? I feel like I cannot find a dessert tasting menu anywhere in New York. Am I missing the boat?
Well, I think part of it has to do with economics. I think, you know, I opened in 2006. By the time 2008 rolled around, there was that economy, you know, crash, and it really affected us all. I mean, desserts were driven restaurant were one of the genre of restaurants to have been cut out. And also learning from the experience that I actually needed a partnership of sorts that had to do with a restaurant to make the business model work. I opened up a bakery right next door to Pong called Batch that right in 2008, actually, that was unable. It was actually doing really well, but it wasn't able to sustain itself because of the tanking of the
headwinds.
Restaurant.
Yeah. I mean, it was just extreme.
It was out of control. And personally, I was going through a lot. I had a divorce and my mom had a stroke. It was just a lot of stuff coming down at once. And I decided to just walk away by that point. And I wouldn't say that, you know, flash forward a decade later, I wouldn't say that it's gone. It's just adjusted its the way it's served. Because you can go to Chungshik for dessert tasting, Hua Ban, which I did recently, which is terrific. So many of the dessert tastings are associated with a restaurant, but also many pastry chefs have morphed into this, you know, type of business model that actually has a cafe like there's, you know, Chanson, which also has a dessert bar in the basement. But if you look across country, you see a lot of these new type of restaurants that open up by pastry chefs. In Los Angeles, there's Friends and Family, Fiona, Willa Jean in New Orleans. There's many types of restaurants that are founded by pastry chef with a strong food service as well.
So you could order at some of those places. I know Fiona, you can order as many desserts and have them all thrown out on your table and have a really fun time.
You've been?
I've met Nicole and I've had her. She's been on the podcast.
Queen.
Oh, it's great. I mean, it's great stuff. Yeah. I haven't been to the restaurant, but she brought some pastries to our interview. But I've just like I like the idea of going and paying like $50-$60 and just having 5 desserts or $80 and having 8 desserts.
By yourself or on a date?
Well, with friends. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, with my wife or with friends, or I think we would have a hell of a time. And I think it's seems like someone should do that. Maybe not in New York because no one should do anything in New York right now, right? It's kind of a crazy
it's
place.
It's tough here. Yeah. But yeah. I think it's, you know, it's it goes through phases, right?
Sure.
Because you know, I think right now, I think New York is real estate makes it very hard for anyone to do any business.
And you're spending a lot of time in Washington, D.C. We'll get to that.
Okay.
But I wanted to, after Pong and Batch, you ended up for the past decade, a lot of your work was in consulting and you've been prolific and you've worked with so many cool chefs and young upstarts and establishment. Tell us a little bit about what that entails. What is a pastry or just a restaurant consulting chef? What do you do?
Actually, that part of my career pretty much fell on my lap after Pong closed. You know, a lot of people came up to me and, you know, wondered what I was going to do next. And, I pretty much chose, you know, the direction of like just doing many types of different things and, you know, see what sticks, you know. And I worked with Häagen-Dazs to develop new ice cream flavors.
What did you invent? Tell us one. What's the flavor you invented?
Well, there was five, and then there was...
low-key, there's five you invented. What, give me one.
No, five, the you know, the five-ingredient ice cream.
Oh, I see. I thought you said you invented five flavors.
Well, there was passion fruit, obviously, Mari lemon, you know, something that's a little bit more esoteric, which I thought farm-to-table was the way to go. And then, there was some kind of cake ice cream, which I thought was going to be interesting. A lot of it had to do with marketing because... Mm-hmm. It's a very established brand and very famous for vanilla strawberry chocolate, and you have your rum raisin.
The best strawberry out there.
Yeah, it's great. And so they were looking for ways to, you know, at that time it was everybody was doing crazy ice cream. You know, Jenny was born, right? Jenny's ice cream. And, you know, it was from a marketing perspective, it's great for them to innovate. I get that. And they're not the only company. Pretty much everyone did. Kit Kat, the bar, launched many crazy flavors. So I worked for General Mills at that time. I opened Coppelia. I still did restaurant work. So opened Coppelia, opened Spot Dessert Bar.
Which is Spot? Are there spots around still?
There's several.
That's what I thought.
Flushing.
Yeah,
I'm no longer a partner in that, but it's flourishing.
Really good
stuff
there. So
that's one place you go to for desserts.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good call. Yeah,
my favorite one was Village Tart, because
Village
I thought
Tart.
That, yeah,
so good,
so good. And you know, it's what is there now, Pascal Jones?
Yeah,
right. So I thought the neighborhood was great. I went to that with Leslie Bernard and Pat Sir. I don't know what happened there in the end. In retrospect, but.
Those are some names, Leslie and Pat.
Yeah.
Throwback.
Right. everyone's moved on now. Restaurants. So, you know, I went back to John George to do some more work for him. I feel really blessed, actually, because I'm surrounded by people who want to work with me again. And so the next 10 years, I was... really busy as a consultant.
Traveling a lot. You love to travel, just for fun. We'll get to that. But tell you, you were traveling. You're in Austin, I know, a lot, doing some work down there.
I did some work in Austin, too, and California. But my favorite has got to be Asia. Since my dad got older, he's in the 90s now, and I always wanted to fly back to Thailand or China or Japan or Hong Kong to take on projects, because after that, I can spend some time with him and get my trip paid for, which is great. And so I was concentrated on that. That kept me out of the country and traveling for a while and exploring and realizing that life is short, that I want to see more. And that kind of got linked to my Instagram, and I'm always traveling, and people don't think that I actually work.
No, you've
because
got
I'm always in a different country.
No, you've got an amazing Instagram. What is it? Just your name?
It's just my name.
Yeah, Pichai Ong. But it is a really great Instagram for world travel, but you are obviously working. And you've grown a following there.
Yes.
People love you on the gram.
Well, that's a fascinating post. And, you know, it's fascinating to see the life of a chef, what it can be in a way. But don't believe it. It's not always true that
it's
I'm
not, you,
there where, when I post.
But also, you are just the most voracious restaurant goer. I've spent time with you in Austin and L.A. and some other cities. And we have hit up more restaurants per day than anyone ever I've dined with. I mean, you could hit up five restaurants.
No way. Really?
We've hit up like eight restaurants before, I feel, you and I.
You must have done 10 with Dookie.
Well, Dookie and I used to do a lot, but you used to, no, but tell us, like, what do you like to, like, tell us a little bit about that method, because I just think it's really fascinating.
Well, first of all, I'm in the industry because I love to eat. That was my main reason for going to the restaurant industry, like, from the get-go, when I first started cooking, you know. I remember I was working at very nice restaurant, Staffoli, Japanese in San Francisco area, and, you know, going to restaurant and, you know, they put... you know, that title, you know, work where you're working next to your reservation and you get like free desserts, you know, it's great. You know, it's that tradition of restaurant treating other industry members is still going strong. And it feels really nice, you know. And so I do love to eat out a lot. I mean, a town like Los Angeles is perfect because it's, you know, you want a taco, you want sushi, you want something that's Californian pizza, right? And you want to cram it all into like one day.
You so want to eat everything there, yeah.
You do. So you kind of create your own tasting menu, you know.
But you're heading to China soon. I think you told me. So when you go to China, how are you thinking about restaurants? Because you also love to hit up like five places in a day when you're in like Beijing, right?
It depends on the city. In a place like Beijing or Shanghai, you could do it. This time I'm actually going to some place to Xi'an, which I've never been to before.
Oh, Xi'an. Cool.
Yeah, so I think it's going to be a bit more cultural trip this time. It's with my dad, and he wants to see history. We're both like fascinated with China and history and our heritage in a way.
What a cool trip.
Yeah, it's nice.
Okay, so let's move forward to the present. And you're spending a lot of time in Washington, D.C. You're working with one of my favorite chefs and just dudes in general, Eric Bruner Yang, at his restaurant, Brothers and Sisters. Talk about hooking up with Eric Bruner Yang and what you're doing there.
Well, I first, chose the path going down to, actually, I live in Virginia because I was dating Jason here in New York. And when he moved down for his job, he works for the government. And we moved down, I moved down with him and started to explore the area. And that happened at the time when Eric was growing Maketo and signing a deal with the Sidell Group to open the Line Hotel, two restaurants at the Line Hotel. And, by this point, Eric was able to basically afford me to be his pastry director. And so, by that point, Eric and I have been friends that had a little bit of, he would say mentorship kind of involved. But to me, I've been around for a while and I wanted to look for a situation where it's almost like family-like kind of environment, because we meet a lot of people in industry and relationships develop, and some ends and some don't last beyond the work. And to me, that's important, because it's not about just the work, because it's about life and relationship building that's long lasting. And I knew that I was going to have that with Eric even beyond the work, because work ends at the end of the day.
Well, it's on the title of the restaurant, Brothers and Sisters.
Yes.
It just says it all there. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing at that restaurant. I don't really know too much. I've never been there. I'd like to check it out sometime.
So Brothers and Sisters is a lobby the restaurant is located in the lobby. And when we discussed in the beginning, Eric wanted to, he's also another traveler, and he goes to his homeland, Taiwan and China and Asia in general, quite a bit. And he wanted to create an American menu that you might find in, let's say, Hong Kong or Taipei. There's something for everyone. There's a Caesar salad and, steak, burger, pork chop, something, a little Asian, but mostly an American menu that draws inspiration from, different types of cuisine around the world. And then centering around that is an all-day program where you serve cakes and high tea, although I don't really call it high tea. I just call it afternoon tea, because high tea has this frou-frou-sounding thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, so you can come to the hotel for any reason at any time of the day for one of my cakes. So that's the majority of what I do at the hotel. And then there's spoken English, which is a standing room, izakaya, tachinomiya style restaurant, where we serve some yakitori skewers, fermented durian curry, Peking duck. You can come for any of these options, and of course, lots and lots of drinks, soju, sake.
Yeah, it's an izakaya style.
Yeah, it's great. And I also have desserts there. One of the desserts come with the Peking duck menu, and then the other two desserts are always rotating seasonally. I think it's a great restaurant for me to do seasonal things that's whimsical and with a funny presentation that I'm known for.
So you spent some time in California, but you spent a lot of time in New York, and you're more... You recently moved to D.C. What's it like running a restaurant in Washington, D.C.? I just have this like horrible image of like governmental people and politics and just not cool people. Sorry, D.C. listeners. I'm just being honest.
Well, truth be told, I left New York, besides dating someone and working with Eric Bruner Yang. It was this same environment for me here, the grind of... money and economy. It really brings people up and down, a lot of downs. Obviously, that's why I chose to check out D.C. I find it to be very similar in that rather than money or economy, it becomes politics. I chose a very strange time to go.
you think?
Because, with the administration. It's odd. I feel the atmosphere is odd. I live in Virginia, which is, a little bit more iffy. But D.C. itself, it's 97%, Democratic. And I think it's a different vibe.
It's so, for sure. And I'm teasing about my hate for D.C. because, yeah, it's a pretty great city once you're in the city and not on the hill. Have you had AOC come into your restaurant yet?
Not yet, but I would love to meet her. I think that she's welcome to come anytime for cake.
I mean, who doesn't want cake at the end of a long day, a long legislation session, right? You need a little cake in your life.
Yes,
right?
It would make you feel better. As Bon Appetit says, it's like the ultimate therapy.
It's true. I think, I mean, a lot of people
cake
say
that.
Cake for coping. We ask all of our guests on the Taste Podcast, if you were to be able to write your dream cookbook project without like budget or any, deadlines in mind, just what would be your dream cookbook project, Piché?
I'm actually trying to sell a cookbook now. It's called Coconuts. It's about...
Coconuts.
Yeah, I'm surprised it doesn't exist yet. I did some research. I started talking about with Andrea Nguyen from California about this
great
book.
Great cookbook author, yeah.
Right, and it's about coconuts because, it's a way of life for a large chunk of the population of the world. And, right now I think it's hitting on many interest groups, from vegan, gluten-free with using the coconut flour. But I think there's a whole, like Asian desserts of... For 2002, when I wrote The Sweet Spot, there's a whole lot of mystery surrounding that genre. But ironically, it's a very mainstream ingredient that you find everywhere. Everyone's drinking coconut water here.
Coconut oil.
But we just don't know how it's harvested, where it comes from, what are the nutrition, and what you could actually use for it. So I thought of doing that.
I think you're going to write this. I feel like this is a good idea.
Are you interested?
Hey, man, if I could buy cookbooks, I would buy that one. I love that.
Let me get the proposal in my back.
Piché, thank you.
I'm ready.
Piché, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Thank you.
Here's Anna speaking with Marcus Glocker.
Welcome to the Taste Podcast, Marcus.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You are from Austria, and a lot of your cooking kind of is right in the crossover between French and Austrian cooking. What is the crossover there? What are the similarities between those two cuisines?
I mean, I think it's a very old world type of cooking, I would say. And I did my apprenticeship in Austria, in Linz, and then I moved sort of to Vienna, moved to Munich, and I never actually worked in Paris, but I sort of always had worked in French-driven kitchens. And so I made sort of my own style of cooking up a little bit, I would say, which is definitely a Viennese type of cooking with French techniques together. And that's what you can experience at the moment at Augustine.
What exactly is Viennese cooking like? And how is it different from the rest of Austria? Because when I think of Austria, I think of strudel, I think of spätzle. But what are the really distinct Viennese flavors and dishes?
I mean, in Austria, it's a very regional cooking. So every part of Austria has sort of their own version of doing even a similar dish, what you can experience in Vienna. But, you're going to go to the Alps. It's a little bit differently prepared. But the Viennese cuisine is actually one of the oldest cuisines. And so they are very rooted in the traditional cooking, which sometimes gets forgotten a little bit, I would say, especially in the younger generation with everybody wants to be a creative and wants to use these recipes and tweak them and make them more modern. But for me, to go back to Vienna and have an old school Tafelspitz, for example, or a strudel, which is made the original way, it's something very unique. I didn't realize that when I lived there, but now I'm over 10 years in New York City and looking back and experienced that food, it's very special.
I recently got to eat some of your food at a dinner at the James Beard House, which was really fun. And you talked about seeking inspiration from some historic recipes from 100 or more years ago. What is the process like of kind of excavating those recipes and making them modern again? Where do you find these really old dishes?
I mean, the old is new again. It's so old that nobody does it. So it's probably the newest thing right now for a lot of chefs to cook those old recipes because nobody does it anymore. Specifically for this dinner, which was the theme of Paris meets Vienna, I think, for example, the conversation tart, which is one of the oldest recipes, actually, I think all of my cooks looked at me like, where is this from? What are we doing? So my pastry chef there, Emiko, was like playing around with this for approximately like 2 or 2.5 weeks. It's basically just one little tart, and I think you tasted it, which has a little puff pastry, frangipane, marmalade, and then on top is royal icing. But the key is you have to cook everything or bake everything together in one shot. So you have to figure out that the inside is soft, the dough is crispy, and the icing is not overcooked. So it's a very interesting, it's a very simple flavors, but to get it right takes a lot of practice.
The icing actually bakes on the tart?
Yes. So you have to bake everything together. So when you eat that, the middle has to be soft and chewy, mm-hmm. and the outside has to be crispy. So we baked it so many times that we figure out the exact timing for this dish. And this recipe is so old. Can you imagine how many people worked on this back in the time to make this perfect? So that was sort of the inspiration for me to get those recipes together with Viennese cuisine as well, because conversation tart is obviously an old school French recipe. And
were they called conversation
tart? Yeah.
Do you have any idea where that name came from? It's great.
There's a long history. You should Google it. It's very interesting, actually. Got created for an event. They wanted to publish a book, and this was the dish or the tart they served for this. I would say for this party back in the time, and it opened conversations. That's what the original idea of this dish was. And the first time I experienced this dish was actually in London when I worked for Gordon Ramsay back in the time, and we had this on the bonbon trolley, and I forgot about it, but I still had a similar recipe in my pocket. I started Augustine, and I thought, like, this is a great tart to bring back.
So did you have to tweak anything from that original conversation tart recipe to make it work with today's ingredients and today's, you know, ovens?
Absolutely.
And equipment? What had to change?
I mean, we had to figure out the time and temperature for the baking process, obviously.
Because a lot of old recipes don't even say a temperature.
Exactly.
Because it was like, before you had a thermometer in your oven.
Now everything is so detailed in every recipe. And back in the time, it was like the chefs were just figuring it out themselves. And when you really look at it, you have 4 ingredients or 5 ingredients there. And it still took us quite a while to figure out the perfect time and temperature to make this happen. So that's sort of an exciting thing. It's not always about being creative. It's sometimes getting as close as possible to the original recipe. And that's exciting, too.
You have a little bit of a background in pastry. Is that right?
I used to work, I wouldn't call myself a pastry person, but I know the basics in pastry. I know what I like in pastry. I love sweets. I'm a sucker for that, I would say. But I know the traditional techniques. And in Europe, when you do an apprenticeship in the kitchen, the savory and pastry is always some sort of together. So you have to spend time in pastry to understand the basics, which really helped me in the process of like running a kitchen as well, because you can point out certain things in pastry, what you like to have, versus you have no idea what's going on there. So that's sort of, it has to be cohesive, it has to be together. And for me personally, I like to use pastry and savory elements as well, so they always should work together.
What is your creative process like with your pastry chefs at Augustine and Bitard? Is it sort of like a back and forth? You know, it looks like sometimes you provide the ideas or the original recipes.
Absolutely.
What is that creative interplay like?
I mean, first of all, I try to, when I go into the kitchen, I always try to have a goal of the day. The goal of the day is maybe it's a new dish, or maybe it's addressing something in the kitchen which I saw maybe the day before when we did service. And, you know, it's just small little things, but it's every day something. And every day there's a creative process for me as well. When I have an idea, I will plant the seed. And to plant the seed is for me going over to pastry, tell them what's going on. This is the conversation dot. Look it up, study it, what's going on there. And then normally they will come back to me and present me their version of the conversation dot. And then I will give them a feedback. And it's a back and forth. But it's rarely that I just give somebody a recipe and say, like, this is exactly what I want to have. I want to have a little bit more than that. I want to have your version or our version and make it more exciting.
You just started at Augustine this past September, is that right?
Correct, yeah.
What are the things that you're cooking now at Augustine that you weren't able to do at Batard until now?
I mean, I would say I could be able to cook in each kitchen the same dishes, but for me it was like just to give you a little background about Augustine. I mean, 2010 I looked first time at this building actually. There was no Augustine, there was no Tom Colicchio Beekman Hotel. I looked at the space and I was intrigued by the building because it was empty for so many years. And obviously I was not in the stage of like taking on a new restaurant. But when I got the opportunity from Keith McNally to step into this kitchen, it's not about my concept, what I wanted to do. I looked at the space and the space for me was Paris meets Vienna. And for me, it was a casual, everyday breakfast, lunch and dinner spot. So that's how I started creating the menu there. And it's definitely very different to Batard. I mean, Batard is doing 6 nights a week dinner service only. We have a smaller restaurant, and yeah, it's a little bit more refined. It's a little bit more wine-driven. And Augustine is sort of a more relaxed, everyday restaurant.
I want to talk about spätzle, one of my favorite foods. And we talked about it a few weeks ago because I wrote about spätzle for Taste. Yeah. You serve a buttermilk chive spätzle at Augustine. That you talked about sort of being inspired by days in childhood, like a long day of skiing and then just hunkering down for some spätzle after that. Tell me about spätzle. Why is it fun for a chef to make? Why is it versatile? Why is it great?
I mean, it's just such a, as you mentioned this correctly, it's a very forgiving pasta, I would say almost. And it's a quick recipe. You can make it refined. You can make it very casual. You have so many different options to work with spätzle. And where I grew up, my family has a hotel back home. So it's a little bit on the mountain. There's not many things around, a few cows and mountains. But, you know, when you come home after skiing and have a big bowl of spätzle with cheese and onions, I mean, it's something very comforting, and that's what I like about this dish. Same way as pasta, it's very comforting, it's always delicious, and you have endless possibilities to work with.
One of the things I realized while researching it is that there are, like, a million different ways of making it. There's, of course, like, the traditional grandmother way of kind of heaping some dough onto a little wooden board and then just chopping it directly into the boiling water.
Yes.
How many different ways have you tried making it, and how did you land on the technique that you use at Augustine?
Again, it's rooted in a lot of history, spätzle, and for the Germans, Schwabenland, it's called, actually, where spätzle are hand-cut, which means, as you described just now, with a cutting board, you have a spatula, and it's sort of fine noodles going directly into the water. That's the way of doing spätzle in Germany. And in Austria, you pass it through a spätzle press, it's called, or I use a perforated hotel pan with little holes and just let the dough slide through it, so you have little sort of canals directly going into the water. But again, this is more about the history of where the spätzle are made. That's sort of the technique.
What is something that you're cooking right now on the menu at Batard or Augustine that you're really excited about, that's kind of new that you're trying out?
I mean, at Augustine, we were just trying to get ready for spring. And what I'm very excited about is I always loved in Vienna when I in the afternoon to go to a coffee place and have a beautiful coffee and a freshly baked cake. And that's sort of like the version of Vienna's high tea, I would almost say. Mm-hmm. And I would like to bring something like this to Augustine, where you have in the afternoon the possibility to go in there, have a cup of coffee, have maybe a glass of champagne, and then a freshly baked fruitcake or whatever is in season, which we try to get Union Square Markets involved in that, and have those daily changing, you know, and you just come in for a quick cake and coffee, maybe a glass of champagne. And that's sort of an exciting process right now, because we're trying to figure out all these recipes and cake recipes and torts, classic torts as well, for this promotion.
I love that every culture seems to have kind of like their own version of that. Like the Scandinavian fika is just a break in the afternoon to have a little sweet, some coffee. It's great.
It's absolutely comforting. It's great. And, you know, on a Friday when you get out of work a little bit early and have in the afternoon a little coffee and cake, maybe a little charcuterie, and call it the weekend.
Love that. Marcus, thank you so much for coming on the Taste Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Taste podcast is hosted by Matt Rodbard and me, Anna Heasel. The show is produced by Gabrielle Lewis, studio recordings by Pat Stango, theme music by Steve Rydell. Interviews are recorded live at Books Are Magic in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, and at Penguin Random House Studios in Manhattan. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com. Thanks for listening.